Talk Shoes.
Recorded live.
Okay, sorry for the brief delay, ladies and gentlemen. My screen just wouldn't, the Talk Shoe command screen simply would not open up for me. I had to try several times, and it finally did open up for me. It's been acting up lately. You may recall about 4 weeks ago, I could not get the Talk Shoe screen up and running at all, but finally did a few seconds ago. And so up and running on Talk Shoe and Eurofolk Radio as well. Now, as you call, last week I talked about George Udvari's article, Could Jesus Be a Jew? And, of course, he answered that in the negative. And so I've decided, because I've got all these articles on Anglo-Saxon Israel, anglo-saxonisrael.com, at the bottom, if you open up that page, at the very bottom, there's about, I think, almost 10 articles entitled Jesus Was Not a Jew by 10 different authors, okay? I didn't have the Udvari one up there, and because I just got that one recently, about a year and a half ago when I drove out to California to pick up a lot of things that were in George Udvari's library. And so I hadn't heard of that one before. And so at some point, I'll include that on Anglo-Saxon Israel as well. But today, I'm going to be focusing on an article by that title, Jesus Was Not a Jew, by W.G. Finlay. And I'm going to have to scroll up and down using my arrows. I can't use my cursor at the moment. So I've got it here. Okay, Jesus Was Not a Jew by W.G. Finlay. I'm sorry, I don't know what the W.G. stands for. I think the W stands for William. Not sure what the G stands for. And, of course, W.G. was the publisher, frequent writer and editor of the Covenant Messenger of South Africa for many, many years. I remember when I was in going to the meetings down at the Christian Patriots Defense League in the early 80s. They would always play Finlay's tapes over the loudspeaker system during the breaks between sessions. And he was a regular. He would send a tape out from South Africa every week. And then those tapes were played at these paramilitary Christian identity meetings. And so he was one of the favorites there. Although I didn't even realize it at the time, W.G. was a Paul basher and did not realize that the bad translations of Paul's writings had made him look like an antinomian and even as a universalist. But that's not true, because I have proven a dozen times or more that it's the translations that make Paul appear that way, and it's deliberate tactic by both the Catholics and the Protestants. Even the King James was infected with this false translation business. In any case, I'm going to start in now on Jesus Was Not a Jew by W.G. Finlay, and I'd say, you know, 95% of his work is really good. It's he never called himself a two-seed liner. However, he was as close to a two-seed liner as he could possibly get. Yeah, because he totally understood that the Jews were totally evil and that they were terrors, irredeemable terrors. So let's go through this. And he takes a different, kind of a different angle. You know, in my teachings, I stress the fact that Yahshua was a Judahite and not a Judean, and certainly not an Edomite Judean, because in the Hebrew, and I think I covered this a little bit last week, the word Yehudi means Judah and can only mean a member of the tribe of Judah or Judah himself. It cannot mean anybody else, and therefore it is a racially exclusive. It's even more exclusive. It's a tribally exclusive term. And, of course, all of the Israelites were forbidden to intermarry with non-whites. So it was a totally exclusive. Now, of course, they violated those laws a lot, especially the 10 northern tribes of Israel when they sunk into paganism. And they associated with Canaanites and were holding the Canaanites in tribute rather than having exterminated them. as Yahweh commanded them to do in Deuteronomy 7:1. But be that as it may, he refers to Jesus as a Nazarene. And, of course, we talked about I-N-R-I, meaning Jesus Nazarenos Rex Judaeorum. And that was, we recalled last week, was a mocking designation. And the Pharisees even wanted Pilate to take that down, that sign, because they didn't accept him as Messiah. And, of course, the Jews, the Edomite Jews, had no Messiah. And they would have killed any Messiah that would have come along, because that Messiah was a threat to their power, their political power. So, but W.G. Finlay takes a completely different tack, and let's see what he has to say. He starts out by quoting Matthew 16:13-16. Whom do men say that I, the Son of Man, say that I am? And they said, some say that thou art John the Baptist, some Elias, and others Jeremias, or one of the prophets. So here the response in Matthew suggests that the people believed that he was one of those people come again, reincarnated. He saith unto them, but whom say ye that I am? And Simon Peter answered and said, thou art the Christ, that is, the Messiah, the Son of the living God. So Peter gave the right answer. The controversy concerning the identity of the Lord Jesus Christ has raged down the centuries, and today, 1900 years after his birth, the subject remains the area of more than a little confusion. In Protestant evangelical circles, he is held to be a Jew. In Roman Catholic thinking, he appears to be an enigma, which, if the accompanying photograph of the Pope's celebration of the Pontifical Mass, Warsaw's Victory Square, is anything to go on, would suggest that both Madonna and Child were of the black or colored race. You've probably seen the black Madonna. In the leftist, if you want to see that drawing, just go to www.anglo-saxonisrael.com and scroll down to Jesus Was Not a Jew, by W.G. Finlay. That's the article I'm reading from, which has this black Madonna pictured. In the leftist political arena of Christianity, as exemplified by the World Council of Churches, he is held as a universal man, totally raceless, and wholly committed to the ideal of the brotherhood of man, which is, of course, the Illuminati Freemasonic idea of liberty, equality, fraternity, the brotherhood of man. And indeed, if you read about the French Revolution, already during those days, the ultra-liberals and communists that instigated the French Revolution were preaching the equality of the races. That was one of their big ideological stances. Of course, there was nothing like that in the American Revolution, nothing at all. In fact, the U.S. Constitution does not grant citizenship to blacks or Indians and relegates blacks to 3/5 of a man's status, and none of them could vote, okay? So it's very obvious that the racial separation that the Bible demands was maintained by the American Revolution and was done away with by the French Revolution to completely opposite thrusts. The American Revolution was Christian. The French Revolution was Jewish and communist. So let's continue. In Jewish circles, he is still said to be an imposter. Yeah, even today. He means today. An imposter? Well, he was certainly not a Jew, not in the sense of an Edomite Jew. Okay, but he was a Judahite, not a simple Judean. There's two kinds of Judeans. Two basic kinds of Judeans, the Judahites, who are a racially pure tribe of Judah, and the Idumeans, who were Edomites, and then you had a smattering of all other people who might have been wandering through and maybe have settled in Jerusalem, being of neither group. So Jerusalem was a huge city, a huge metropolis. It was kind of like the New York City of its day. Okay, that's what we're dealing with here. And, by the way, somebody mentioned John Friend. John Friend is going to interview me on February 29th, and we're going to talk about the confusion of David Duke and Kevin McDonald in trying to exonerate the Jews from the fact that they're not Israelites. But both Kevin MacDonald and David Duke, and you know the story well, I've talked about it many times, they believe that the Ashkenazim are Israelites, and that's absurd. That's an utterly absurd idea. So John Friend and I are going to talk about that on, I think it's the 29th of this month. So, okay. So, one of the things we're trying to do at Eurofolk Radio is, because not everybody is identity. Some people are white nationalists. Some people are, you know, Christians, or one single seed line identity, who understand that the Jews are evil, but don't believe that they're the children of the devil, the literal offspring of the devil, as we two seed liners do. So, you know, we try to give voice to all shades of pro-white opinion. And so we're going to have some disagreement. Joe Cortina, I think it was Joe who had some bad things to say about the Old Testament, because he buys into this idea that the Old Testament is a Jewish book. Okay. So anyway, I'm going to try to clear some of those things up. Okay. And Frank Collin, I think Frank Collin is a Jew. Actually, Frank Collin was a Jew. You know, Frank Collin was the guy who led the Nazi demonstration in Skokie, Illinois. I forget what year it was. And it turned out he was a Jew pretending to be a Nazi. So, and of course, that's all hushed up. Nobody ever talks about that anymore, ever since it was discovered that Frank Collin was a Jew. But in any case, let's get back to the article. And one other thing. Chris Peed's New Ensign newsletter is now going to be a part of Eurofolk Radio. So you can access Chris Peed's newsletter from now on at Eurofolk Radio. I'm not exactly sure when that's going into effect, but his newsletter is really outstanding. Contains a lot of my articles, too. And a lot of good stuff. Oh, man. Arnold Kennedy, he features a lot of the work of Arnold Kennedy, who, again, also was so close to being a two-seed liner. It's amazing that he wasn't, but he understood that the Jews are our enemies. So it's very important for those in the white nationalist movement who understand that the Jews are the enemy of the white race. We try to embrace them and try to explain identity to them as best as they can. Obviously, if you've been raised all your life believing that the Jews are the Israel of the Old Testament, it takes a little while for some people to unload that false idea. But let's continue here. And just starting with that sentence again, in Jewish circles, he is still said to be an imposter, and concerning his birth, the Jewish Encyclopedia, 1904 edition, volume 7, page 70, comments on the prevailing thought that he was the illegitimate son of Pandera, a Roman soldier. Over recent years, a new trend has developed which has given substance to the question asked by the Lord Jesus Christ, as posed in the quotation which prefaces this article, "Whom say ye that I am?" In those days, and despite the religious fanaticism of the Pharisees, men were still entitled to their own views. Well, they're still entitled to their own views here in America. And what we're seeing here is the Jews are the ones trying to take away our right to freedom of speech. By the way, Perfect Law of Liberty, and I'm going to be doing my series, I'm going to have to redo my series on the Constitution and the Bible. Some of you may remember I did that series on Prove All Things Radio. This was about 4 years ago, I think. And unfortunately, I didn't have the technology. I wasn't as far as advanced as I am now in saving my shows to my own computer and backing them up. And I thought that Prove All Things had those backed up, and it turned out they didn't. So, Frank Cohen. Yeah, I was just making false accusation after false accusation. Frank Collin, you know, stop it already. So anyway, let's continue. I'm going to have to redo those shows. That's all there is to it. And if anything, they'll be better because I'm going to prove that the U.S. Constitution is 100% biblical. And there was only one area where I had any doubt, and that's the passage where it says Congress has the right to coin money. But then I realized, because it wasn't talking about paper money, because it was later defined as gold and silver, which is perfectly biblical. So Congress, that is our government, we, Israel, and that's what our Constitution is, we the people, the posterity, and in the Declaration of Independence it says our brethren, the British, and of course our consanguinity. America was about 40% German at the time, too. And there were a lot of Danes and Issachar and Naphtali, etc., etc. America is the regathering of the 12 tribes. There's no doubt about it. So our Constitution is an Israelite document. It's a completely Israelite document, and it adheres to the law from beginning to end, unlike Ted Weiland's false claims about the Constitution. Anyway, I'm going to take Mr. Weiland to task on his false opinion, so, and address his claims one by one and show where he's wrong. But in any case, let me continue here. And what we have is a modern view of who was Jesus, what was he? And of course, most of the modernists say, well, he didn't exist. So you have this secular strain. By the way, that secular strain is also guided by the Jews, because we have what's called Judeo-atheism. You have all these Jews running around pretending to be atheists, when in reality they're Satanists, just like the Talmudists are. So they're just playing both sides of the fence, as they always do. They demand leadership of both sides of the debate, and then they make sure that no third voice or no contrary opinion can get in. And so that's what they're doing. So you have all these Jews running around, even denying the Old Testament, you know, and to create doubt about the Bible itself. That's their purpose. But in reality, they're all Satanists. So he continues, So despite the religious fanaticism of the Pharisees, men were still entitled to their own views, as we still are entitled to today. But today it would appear that unless one conforms with prescribed identity norms, state machinery is invoked, which curtails the publishing of views other than those prescribed. In South Africa, the July edition of the South Africa Observer was banned, and among the reasons given for this banning was that the editor contended that Jesus was not a Jew. Oh, you broke the law. You stated the truth. It should be stated that this was only one of several reasons, but it surely calls into question the Christian liberty in a professed Christian country. Well, at that time, supposedly. But as Pastor Martins has instructed me over the last year and a half, South Africa was really run by Freemasons, Christian in name only. Next heading, who was Jesus of Nazareth? Unless one is prepared to discount the gospel accounts, one must provide the unequivocal answer to this question with the confession that Christ, the Son of the living God, just as Peter did. It would not be a digression to continue with Matthew's account of the Lord's reaction to his confession. But as with his identity, much confusion has arisen because of theological interpretation of his response. He said, "Blessed art thou, Simon Bar-Jonah, for flesh and blood hath not revealed it unto thee, but my Father which is in heaven. And I say also unto thee that thou art Peter, and upon this rock I will build my church, and the gates of hell shall not prevail against it." Let's see what WG has to say about this. There is obviously something amiss here, for in one breath the Lord calls him Simon Bar-Jonah, and the next, Peter. In John 1:42, when Simon Bar-Jonah was called to follow the Lord, Jesus had nicknamed him Cephas, or more correctly Petros, which of course means a stone or a rock. In Isaiah 51:1, Abraham is referred to as a rock, from whence the Israel family was hewn, and Peter, because he was a chip from that rock, was renamed as Petros, a stone chipped from that rock. Thus, in the Lord's reaction, one is directed to the national family of the Old Testament. Very good, WG. I never would have made that connection. Outstanding. The family whose commitment was totally to the accomplishment of God's oath-bound covenant in the earth, and also, I might say, that since the covenants were made exclusively with the houses of Judah and Israel, it's all an Israel exclusive. Here was one of the covenant family which acknowledged that he, Jesus, was the, capital T-H-E, anointed one, as God the Father had promised through his servants the prophets, who would redeem Israel, make an end of sin, and bring in everlasting righteousness, that from Daniel 9:24. Now, of course, since it's a two-stage prophecy, he redeemed Israel of our past sins, but we still have not got everlasting righteousness and an end to sin. That's going to come with the second advent. Continuing, it was on this confession that Yahshua, I'm just going to insert Yahshua, because Finlay was not a user of the sacred names, that Yahshua stated he would build or confirm, Greek oikodomeo, his church, confirm his congregation. It is, of course, a matter of history, and, of course, if you read the Gospel of Luke, it says repeatedly he came for Israel, and even in Matthew, I come not for, but for the lost sheep, exiled sheep of the house of Israel, which Ecclesia, now he's got this right here, let me start this over. It is, of course, a matter of history that theologians prefer the word church to the Greek word Ecclesia, for while the Greek word means a called-out assembly, separated, which in the days when it was used was an exclusive term precluding slaves and aliens, that is, excluding slaves and aliens. But, of course, even slaves is a bad term because the Israelites did not have slaves in the modern sense. They were all conscripted laborers who were working off their debt. And once their debt was worked off, they were set free. So they were not slaves in perpetuity, as the common idea is, you know, put forth today. And a lot of Christians don't even realize this. So indentured servants is what they were, not, you know, lifelong slaves. So let's continue. It means a called-out assembly, which in the days when it was used was an exclusive term precluding indentured servants and aliens. The Greek kuriakos, belonging to Yahweh, is preferred because it suits the doctrines of men. So they substitute for ecclesia kuriakos, which is a completely different word. See, these are Churchian tricks. Churchian tricks of translation. If Yahshua intended to build or inaugurate a church on Peter's confession, why did he not use the Greek word kuriakos, which was the etonym of the modern English word church, or etymon? Why did he use the word ecclesia, a word understood by the disciples as having an exclusively national sense? Yes, it was exclusive to Israel. Well, that's precisely why the Churchians don't use it, because they're universalists and their translations are an attempt to universalize the Gospels. The family line. While the Lord told Peter that flesh and blood had not revealed it to him, but his Father in heaven, the written scriptures today provide their testimony, and one is able to see the identity of Yahshua as neither Jew nor colored, nor universal. He always had a very dry, if you've never heard any of the lectures of W.G. Finlay, he had a very droll and dry delivery that it was actually so clever the way he came across. But he was deliberately being really clever. Okay, and so I'm going to see if I can kind of duplicate it here and there, because I remember all those tapes, and I listened to dozens, if not hundreds of them, because in the 20 years from 1980 to 2002, while I was working on The Great Impersonation, I listened to many of his tapes. Okay, so let's continue here. There are, of course, two accounts which purport to be the genealogy of the Lord Jesus Christ, but as these are examined, it becomes obvious that they are not the same, and in point of fact, deal with two branches of the same family, i.e. the two sons of David, Solomon and Nathan, which we covered last week as well. So WG, he's got his stuff down here. The first account is recorded by Matthew, who shows the descent of Joseph, who became Mary's husband after the birth of Yahshua, from David via Solomon by Bathsheba. And this comes from 2 Samuel 12:24. As the advent of Yahshua was characterized by the virgin birth, one wonders why this genealogy of Joseph was included and why it was begun with the preface, quote, the book of the generation of Jesus Christ, the son of David, etc. One can only surmise that Matthew, who was in all probability a Levite, Mark 2:14, was very conscious of the legal implications as they dominated the thinking of the true Israelites who had been converted to Pharisaism. Very well said, Matthew 23:15. And he therefore included the genealogy of Joseph, although making it very clear that he, Joseph, did not beget Jesus. As we talked about last time, the point of including Joseph was that Joseph was his legal, quote-unquote, legal father, not his physical father. And the point being that either way, Yahshua would have qualified as king of Israel, because his mother was in fact an Israelite of the house of David, and so was his stepfather, or father-in-law, however you want to put it. I think stepfather is the correct term here. It is very clear that he did not beget Jesus, who was called Christ. Having overcome the legal hurdle, Matthew then proceeds to elaborate on the virgin birth and draws attention to the prophecy of Isaiah, which was made in the national context of Israel. He relates that Joseph was about to end his engagement to Mary because she was with child when the angel of Yahweh appeared to him and told him of the circumstances of the conception, which we will quote right here, Matthew 1, verses 21 through 23. And she shall bring forth a son, and thou shalt call his name Jesus, or Yahshua. For he shall save his people, Yahshua means Yahweh saves, his people from their sins. Now all this was done that it might be fulfilled which was spoken of Yahweh by the prophet, saying, behold, a virgin shall be with child, and, it says Arid, it should be and shall bring forth a son, and they shall call his name Emmanuel, or God be with us. So, what is this saying? The Jews, of course, deny, and the secularists all deny that such a thing as a virgin birth is possible. However, in the Septuagint, which is the Greek translation of the Hebrew Old Testament done around 230 BC by 70 Judahite scribes translating from the Hebrew into the Greek, they do use the Greek word for virgin, not just young maiden. And plus, it would have been an uneventful prophecy that if a young maiden had conceived, why bother even saying it, right? That's the way it works, unless you want to differentiate a young maiden from an old maiden. Let's continue. The information which the angel of the Yahweh imparted to Joseph, was no sudden and startling revelation of a new development which was to take place. It was a reiteration of that which the prophets of Israel had written, and the Israelites would have been familiar with the prophecy, unlike the Jews. And Joseph, being a pure Israelite, the genealogy proves the point, and unimpeded by Pharisaic delusions, could understand and accept immediately the fulfillment of Israelitish prophecies made some 5 and 7 centuries earlier. I had never thought of this either. Did Joseph, actually, when the angel explained to him that Mary had conceived by the Holy Spirit, did he say to himself, my wife-to-be is the fulfillment of this prophecy. Did he actually think those thoughts? The Bible doesn't tell us, but W.G. Finlay implies that that was what was going through Joseph's mind. Very interesting. I never thought of that. That's very interesting. Anyway, he continues. He could recognize the Isaiah prophecy concerning the sign of the virgin birth, Isaiah 7:14, and could accept the statement, "He shall save his people from their sins," as this had been stated by both Isaiah at Isaiah 53:12 and Daniel 9:24. Matthew's account, therefore, apart from overcoming the legal hurdle, presented the advent in a national context, which is precisely what Yahweh or Yahshua himself insisted. Matthew 20:15-24, "I come not but unto the lost sheep of the house of Israel," and what he stated to Peter, Matthew 16:18. The second genealogy of Yahweh is of Yahshua is presented in Luke 3:23-38, and is indeed the line of Mary, the human vehicle through which the Word was made flesh, John 1:14. It is absolutely true that Joseph is mentioned as the male head of the line, Luke 3:23, but unlike the natural generation found in Matthew's statement, Mathan begat Jacob and Jacob begat Joseph, the husband of Mary, etc. No such natural generation is found. In the authorized version, it is stated that he was the son of Heli, H-E-L-I. And notwithstanding the fact that the word son does not appear in the Greek text and is characterized as such by italics, in the authorized version, the relationship is derived from his marriage to Mary. He became the son-in-law to Heli, is what he's trying to say. Again, translations make a huge difference, and here's another example of the KJV Translation Committee adding a word that isn't there. The account in Luke's Gospel does more than merely identify the Davidic ancestry of Mary. It amplifies the quotation made by the angel of Yahweh to Joseph when he said that he, Yahshua, would save his people from their sins, Matthew 1:21. Note that it doesn't say he will save the world from its sins. It says he will save his people, Israel, from their sins. If one has access to the Greek text of Luke's account, it will be noted that the translators have inserted the words "the son" before each name in the genealogy, which are certainly not in the original text. Although the of in the Greek suggests fatherhood. Conversely, they omitted the definite article, which in the text precedes each proper name, and although this may have made the English translation grammatically correct, it has certainly clouded the issue concerning the identity of his people. The identity of his people is obviously Israel. If Mary's genealogy is followed through from Heli, it will be noted that it passes through the Davidic house, through Abraham, through Shem, through Noah, and back to Enos, the son of Seth, who was the son of the Adam. If the authorized version is reconsidered, it will be noted that verse 38 of Luke 3 reads, "which was the son of Enos, which was the son of Seth, which was the son of Adam, which was the son of Elohim." The Greek text reads, "which was of the Enos." That's interesting. So, the one and only, okay, which was of the one and only Enos, which was of the one and only Seth, which was of the one and only Adam, which was of the one and only Elohim, the Elohim of Israel. That truth has been sacrificed for grammatical correction cannot be doubted here, for in eliminating the definite article which precedes the word Adam, confusion arises as to which Adam is referred to, that in Genesis 1:26 or Genesis 2:7. Again, we find that Mr. Finlay disagrees with Fink and Emmehiser, who state that the Adam in Genesis 1:26 and 2:7 are the same. No, they're not. Genesis 1:26 refers to the species, male and female, he created them, speaking of all Adamite men and women. And in Genesis 2:7, it's obviously speaking of just one man, Adam, and one woman, Eve. There's absolutely no evidence to suggest that the Adam of Genesis 1:26, simply translated as man in the Authorized Version, was given any law, whereas the Adam, again simply translated as man in Genesis 2:7, was certainly given the law, as was symbolized in the tree of knowledge of good and evil, actually the tree of life. The tree of knowledge of good and evil represents mixing the two, mixing evil and good together. And that's what the problem was. They didn't realize that once you mix good and evil together, what do you get? Well, it's evil. Good must remain free of evil to remain good. Evil will still be evil no matter how much good you mix in with it. It's still going to be evil because there's always evil there. Having transgressed the law of God, an act which gave rise to the expression sin, 1 John 3:4, by the way, that's New Testament, so sin still existed in New Testament times. It became necessary that propitiation be made for this. Hence the angel's statement, "He shall save his people from their sins." The family line is thus clear and unmistakable and cannot be equated with the contention of universal man. Oh, man, I just have to... Well said, W.G. Finlay. Well said. He shall be called a Nazarene. I can see we're not going to get done with this today, but this is really good stuff. It deserves two parts. In Matthew 2:33, which deals with the sequel to the death of Herod, who had ordered the massacre of all children under the age of 2 years. Now, question class. Question class. Anybody who wants to type the answer in the chat room, go ahead. Who was Herod? Was he a Judahite or an Edomite? Any answers in the chat room? There you go. Edomite. Thank you very much. Herod was an Edomite. He was not a Judahite. And unfortunately, Kike, that's a good answer too. Okay. Folks, this is a very racially exclusive message here from W.G. Finlay. He was, despite his false reading of Paul, was a great scholar of the Bible. Absolutely fantastic. He was right. He's a two-seat liner, even though he never calls himself that. I think because he was in South Africa and the concept of one-seat liner, two-seat liner maybe never made its way, because that's an American idea, never made its way to South Africa, so he never used that terminology. So let's continue. He shall be called a Nazarene. In Matthew 2:33, which deals with the... by the way, class, you get an A. Pop quiz, you all did really well. Which deals with the sequel to the death of Herod, who had ordered the massacre of all children under the age of 2 years. It will be noted that Joseph, having sought safety in Egypt, now decided to return home. Now we're talking of Joseph of Christ's time, not the Joseph of ancient days. Quote, "And he came and dwelt in a city called Nazareth, that it might be fulfilled which was spoken by the prophets, he shall be called a Nazarene." Okay, now this is going to be a tough one. Pop quiz. What does Nazarene mean? And it derives from the word Nazarite. I wonder if WG gets into it here. But that's a tough one. I don't think many people know the answer to that one. But there's a saying in the Old Testament, "Her Nazarites were purer than snow, whiter than snow." Nazarite means very white. That's what it means. The first point which strikes one is that nowhere in the Old Testament does this name appear which immediately brings into question the authenticity of the statement, "He shall be called a Nazarene." Now, that's not exactly true. I just quoted the statement, her Nazarites were whiter. I think it's whiter than wool or whiter than snow. I forget the exact quote. So there's an inclination that a Nazarite, and of course, what's a Nazarite? I think the Nazarites were a sect that eschewed alcohol, and they didn't cut their hair. I think Samson was one. Okay, and Samson got his strength from letting his hair grow, and he lost his strength when his hair was cut. He was a Nazarite. And then he also married Delilah, who, although I think Delilah was white, she was still a Philistine. See, the Philistines, Leroy, the article I'm reading from is from Anglo-Saxon Israel. And we'll see if it pastes. Okay, yeah, very good. Jesus Was Not a Jew by W.G. Finlay. And that was a particular sect. They did not drink alcohol. They did not cut their hair. And there were other rules. They had very, very specific. It was kind of like a monkish sect that had very, very specific and strict rules. So let's continue. While this statement positively dissociates Jesus of Nazareth from the Jews, it creates a problem which can only be solved by considering the Hebrew and Greek texts once again. The fallacy of the statement, Jesus the Jew, will become obvious as the subject of Nazareth is explored, and the first step in this direction in the consideration of the word Nazareth itself. The first point which strikes one is that nowhere in the Old Testament does this name appear, which immediately brings into question the authenticity of the statement, "He shall be called a Nazarene." If no such place existed in the Old Testament, how could the prophets write about it? Well, it's not every word in Scripture, or every Hebrew word, is used in the Hebrew Scriptures. There were, words that were left out, although there are about 8,000 words used in the Hebrew. There were obviously more Hebrew words than were used in the Bible. So that's just one point about that. So just because the word Nazarene wasn't used in the Old Testament doesn't mean that it doesn't exist. So what we're going to see here is this concept, Nazarene, is very important. The Hebrew root which developed into the name Nazareth was Netzer, N-E-T-Z-E-R, which literally means a branch. And this word is found in the Old Testament and is associated with the situation arising out of Israel's transgression of God's holy law. It will be recalled that through Solomon's transgression of the law, the 12-tribe kingdom of Israel was divided into two sections, 1 Kings 12:16 through 20. The majority northern kingdom became subject to successive waves of Assyrian invasions until finally in 721 BC, its capital, Samaria, was finally taken. If one follows the history of these invasions and notes the degree of impact that these made, it will be noted that while the territory of the tribes of Zebulun and Naphtali in the region of the Sea of Galilee were afflicted, there is absolutely nothing to suggest that all of the people of these tribes were taken under captivity, as were the Ephraimites of Samaria. Isaiah, who wrote during the period when the Assyrian invasions were taking place, wrote of God's intention to bring the northern kingdom to an end, but in the process some would be left in the land in the northern regions and away from the center of activity, as it were, or away from Assyrian influence. And in that day it shall come to pass that the glory of Jacob shall be made thin, and the fatness of his flesh shall wax lean. It should be noted that nothing is said of making it disappear altogether. And it shall be as when the harvestman gathered his corn and reapeth the ears with his arm. These can't be Jews, because the Jews don't do any farming. And it shall be as he that gathereth ears in the valley of Rephaim. Yet gleaning grapes shall be left in it, as the shaking of an olive tree, two or three berries in the top of the uppermost bough, four or five in the outmost fruitful branches thereof, saith Yahweh of Israel. Isaiah 17:4-6. Now this sounds like an an agricultural statement. Of course, that is the way it works for the purposes of literal gleaning, which the Israelites were commanded to do so that the poor would not starve. People who had no means of support could glean from what was left over from the fields. And the Israelites were commanded to do that. These fruitful branches were written of as para netzer, the word para being dropped and the people and land simply being known as Netzer, which eventually developed into Nazareth. One may therefore see in the name Nazareth an association with those in Israel who were not taken into the Assyrian captivity and who remained in their land despite the changes which were taking place in the territory of their brethren in the south. While the word Netzer applied to those Israelites who were the branches of the uppermost bough of Jacob, Isaiah made reference to another Netzer. And there shall come forth a rod out of the stem of Jesse, and a branch shall grow out of his roots. You will notice that the Bible constantly uses tree symbolism for the people of Israel. For the people of Israel. And of course, Yahshua is that branch, and he is that stem, rod out of the stem of Jesse, Isaiah 11:1. The association of this branch, which came from the stem of Jesse, and those branches of Jacob, which had been left in the land, was unmistakable, for in John 1:11, Isaiah 11:1 and John 1:11, it is stated that he came up unto his own, and his own received him not, while in Matthew 13:54, his own is qualified as the people of Nazareth. And when he was come into his own country, he taught them in their synagogue, and they were offended in him. But Jesus said unto them, a prophet is not without honor, save in his own country and in his own house. That's because the people think they know him better, or they know him too well. You know, that little kid who was crawling around in the dirt, that can't be the Messiah. In this, one may see that he was indeed a Nazarene. In the first instance, the branch among the branches of Jacob, and secondly, a Nazarene, because he lived and taught there, except when it was necessary for him to visit the Judean capital of Jerusalem again. Notice the terminology he uses, the Judean capital of Jerusalem, not the Jewish capital of Jerusalem, even though the Edomite Jews had ipso facto taken it over through the Herodian Edomites. But he correctly distinguishes between Judahite, which Jerusalem was a Judahite city until the day that John Hyrcanus started circumcising Edomites and brought them into citizenship, which was a violation of the law. Those Edomites were the first Judeans. Judean being a cross between Judahite and Idumean being the territory occupied by the Edomites. So you can see that the two words brought together, Judean. So in other words, the word Judean means a bunch of mixed race people, although not necessarily all the people were of mixed race. It was just two breeds, two types of people, two ethnicities living in the same territory. The big difference, therefore, between Judah and Judean. Judea and its inhabitants. Having seen that Nazareth in Galilee was peopled by the descendants of those true Israelites who had escaped the deportation by the Assyrians, attention is now focused on the minority section of the 12 tribes, the two tribes of Judah and Benjamin. The Babylonians, who succeeded the Assyrians as the then world power, devastated the land occupied by the two remaining tribes and took them into captivity, where they languished for the 70-year duration of the empire's existence. During this time, nomadic people took possession of the land, as stated in Ezekiel 33:24, and there is no means whereby they can be identified except to note that they were not of the family of Abraham, for they stated Abraham was one, and he inherited the land, but we are many, and the land is given us for an inheritance. Now, here he is actually wrong. In 1 Kings, or it's either in 1 Kings or 2 Kings, we are told the story of how the Assyrians took Babylonians, such as the Sepharvaim, the Sepharvaim, hello, the Sephardic Jews from one of the provinces of Babylon, and placed them in the area that was depopulated of Israelites. And these same people actually sent to the 10 northern tribes for a priest because lions were killing them. So apparently WG is not aware of that section of the story. When, under the decree of Cyrus, the Medo-Persian king, a remnant of the Babylonian captivity, returned to rebuild Jerusalem, Ezra 1:2, certain adversaries were drawn to the work, which again suggests that another unnamed element was present in the land. Well, no, they are named in the Book of Kings. And those were Edomites, Canaanites. Oh, he even says, recounts some of them from the Book of Ezra. But these people were brought in by the Assyrians to take the place of the Israelites that they had deported. And among these were very clearly the Sepharvaim, from which the word Sephardic Jew comes from. Okay, so Ezra recounts that the Canaanites, the Hittites, the Perizzites, the Jebusites, the Ammonites, the Moabites, the Egyptians, and the Amorites were still in the land. Ezra 9:1. If one considers how relatively small the territory was and the wide diversity of people who subsequently took up residence there, one can appreciate something of the story of the land which came to be known as Judea, actually Samaria. That land became known as Samaria. That's where the non-Israelites, the non-Judahites to the Judahites to the south, and the Israelites to the north, and we're specifically talking those Israelites that were not taken into captivity, but also the tribe of Benjamin, somehow, for some reason, wound up north of Samaria near their brethren of the 10 lost tribes. Okay, so in the days of Christ, in apostolic times, we see the house of Judah living in Judea, which used to be known as Judah, and the rest of the 12 tribes, 11 tribes in this case, living in Samaria, or north of Samaria, in what was then called Galilee, the Galilee being the center of the territory. So, let's continue here. It is not known who coined the name Judea, but it is known that the territory so named comprised an area of some 55 miles from the north to south and from 25 to 30 miles in width. I already explained how that name arose. It has been suggested that the name was derived from Judah, which could have been the case, but to call the whole population by the name of a small portion of a remnant of the tribe of Judah, which returned, would have been as ludicrous as suggesting that South Africans are part and parcel of the general term African. The name Judea was a territorial. Now, this is absolutely right. The name Judea was a territorial and not a racial or tribal one. And when it is considered that the modern English word Jew is derived from the historical Judea, because that's where the Jews were never part of Judah, it will be seen that a geographical and not a racial term has been perpetuated. Well said, W.G. Finlay. I see I only have about 6 minutes left. This show is flying by. I'll certainly be able to finish this portion here. The northern boundary of Judea certainly did not take in Galilee, nor did it cover the people living, nor did it take in Samaria. Samaria was between Galilee and Judea, nor did it cover the people living there, the difference being so great that even the dialect spoken in the north differed from the Judeans, Matthew 26:69-73. It was from the Galileans that Yahshua selected his disciples, and on the occasion of calling Nathanael, it will be noted how far the Pharisaic propaganda had penetrated. It will be recalled that the Hebrew Netzer, which covered the true Israelites who had been left in the land and who had never been associated with the population of Judea, finally developed into Nazareth. Facts which were certainly known to the hierarchy which now controlled Judea, certainly those Judeans who were Judahites, as Joseph was. Finally, with the population of Judea finally developed into Nazareth, facts which were certainly known to the hierarchy, which now controlled Judea. In typical vein, they coined an expression based on the identity of the people, which was contrasted with their own heterogeneous origins. Can there any good thing come out of Nazareth? John 1:46. In other words, the Judeans snubbed their noses at the Nazarenes, at the Galileans, at the Benjamites. Here, without a shadow of a doubt, is the work of the anti-God conspiracy, which in David's time had raised its head and had proclaimed its mission at the demise of Israel, Psalm 83:1-4. The remnant of true Israel, the uppermost branches, were in Nazareth, while the cosmopolitan Judeans were claiming to be God's chosen people. It is small wonder that they, the counterfeit, and of course he's referring to the Edomites here, that they, the counterfeit, engendered a complex within the Nazarenes. Can there any good thing come out of Nazareth? Now, folks, we have a similar situation here today where the Judeo churches look down at us, identity people, as, oh, we're the heretics. No, we're not, folks. It's you Judeans, you Judeo-Christians. You Judeo-Christians, you're the odd man out because you are the apostates. We're the ones teaching the true religion, and you have modernized your biblical thinking and Judaized it to such an extent that you can't tell the difference between Judah and Jew. You can't tell the difference. And you certainly should be able to tell the difference between Judah and Judean. But you don't, because you never once in your life whipped out a concordance to look up a single word. Compare that with identity scholarship, which has a concordance in one hand and a Bible in the other. So with the few seconds I have left, I'm going to read Psalm 83:1-4. Keep not your silence, O Elohim. Hold not your peace, and be not still, O Elohim. For lo, your enemies make a tumult, and they that hate you have lifted up the head. They have taken crafty counsel against your people and consulted against your hidden ones. Crafty counsel means conspiracy. There is a conspiracy against the hidden ones. Who are the hidden ones? The remnant. We of Christian Israel. The hidden ones. Those who obey his commandments and call upon his name. Revelation 12:17. Folks, it is an honor and a pleasure to serve you, the modern remnant of true Israel in the world today, the Christian identity people, and includes a smattering of other whites who obey the laws, even though they're not at all aware that they are Israelites. A lot of Christians out there are good people. They obey the law whether they realize it or not, and they're not going to be condemned merely for the fact that they are blind to their identity. We hope and pray that they one day awake, especially, it would be especially good if they awaken before the judgment day. That's my message for today. We'll pick this up next week. Thanks for listening. Praise Yah, we pass the ammunition. See you next time.